News Talk Breakfast, in association with AIR, supporting your business on our mobile network right across Ireland.
Welcome to Breakfast Business with Vincent Wall. Coming up in the next half hour, we assess one potential way to maintain tariff-free trade for the island of Ireland food produce in the event the UK does leave the EU Customs Union. And we hear why the UK's Serious Fraud Office alleges a criminal conspiracy at Barclays Bank. But first, Aidan Donnelly of Davy joins us to review the morning's main stories and latest market developments. Aidan, I know like most brokers in Dublin, you can't comment on AIB this week. Just to cover, I suppose, a development last night, Joe Brennan in the Irish Times write that the government has narrowed the price range at which it expects to float AIB on the stock market this week, reducing the maximum it can achieve for an initial stake sale to almost €3.6 billion. The new price range values AIB at between 11.4 and €12.5 billion. Investment bankers involved in Europe's largest IPO so far this year said on Tuesday evening that they've secured enough orders 2 days before the deal is expected to be finalised to buy all the shares at the upper half of the new guidance. Now, to other stories. Jose Mourinho looking out at us from most newspapers this morning.
He certainly is.
He's got caught up in this Spanish tax fraud.
Yes, I'm just wondering who you use for your image rights, you know, when all those big checks start coming through. Yeah, this is just a flow on really from, you know, we've seen it come to the fore again with the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo and Falcao, the Monaco footballer. And it's basically where money has been paid to them via British Virgin Islands companies and actually two companies registered in Dublin. And the Spanish tax authorities are going after an awful lot of these, trying to claim back taxes for payments that have been made. And naturally enough, Mourinho's representatives have released documents last night saying that he was in complete tax compliance with all of his obligations. So I think this is just it's likely to continue on for quite some time. And I'm sure, you know, it all seems to be the common link here seems to be Jorge Mendes, the well-known Portuguese football agent, who seems to be the common denominator in a lot of these. And I would have thought that, you know, this fishing expedition that the Spanish authorities are going on is whether it's going to catch a whale or not, it's certainly going to probably bait the waters.
Yeah, well, I suppose there may be different issues involved, but they did actually charge and convict Messi, didn't they?
Yes, they certainly did. So, yes. You know, it is a... I think it's going to be a drawn-out affair, and whether checks are paid or whatnot, at the end of it, time is going to tell.
I suppose draws further public or international attention to our, let's say, flexible tax arrangements here.
Yes.
This Moy Park, the biggest employer in the north, it's got a small operation in Dublin, biggest poultry producer in Europe, I think. It's really been part of a merry-go-round with Brazilian owners, hasn't it?
It certainly has, and it's a bit unfortunate for them because the business itself seems to be doing very, very well. It had it recorded pre-tax profits of just over 35 million pounds sterling in 2015. It was bought by the Brazilian meatpacking giant JBS. Now, unfortunately, they're going through annus horribilis themselves. At the minute, they were forced to pay a lenience fee to settle the role in a Brazilian corruption scandal. So as a result of all of this, they're basically trying to sell off a lot of their assets, and they've identified a few assets, one of them being Moy Park, that they're looking to try to sell. It was bought back in 2015 for around $1.5 billion. It was a big price paid at that stage. So
the fact that it's a fire sale, probably they won't get that back.
I can't imagine they will. And as I said, they have identified three or four different assets that they ultimately want to sell. One is a US-focused cattle feeding business. The other one is a Vigor Alimentos, which is... I think it's a Brazilian business that they own as well. So they are really trying to sell some of the family jewels here in order to get some cash in. And, you know, you would hope that certainly there should be, given the fact that the Moy Park business is a very, very good one, there should be a few interested parties in trying to pick that one up.
It employs an amazing 8,500 people.
It's incredible, when you think about it.
Is this development whereby Chinese domestic stocks, Aidan, are now going to be included in the emerging market MSCI index. Is that significant in the long term?
I think it's probably much more significant in the long term, in that it gives a kind of a credence to the Chinese market in the global context. I think in terms of the nearer term reaction, it's going to be very, very muted, because it actually comes in two very, very small phases. So like it'll start in May next year, and it'll really just mean that the domestic shares within China, and there's a very convoluted system over in China, where there's what are called domestic shares, and then overseas shares are basically listed in Hong Kong as well, but it's the domestic shares now that are going to be included. But they're really going to factor in to the extent that they're only going to be less than 1% of the emerging market index, so it's really quite small.
The real issue there, I suppose, over time is how investors actually get to appreciate their true worth.
Correct. And you know, it's probably because it's been included now, it means that the international investors now have the right to get access to the domestic shares, and up until this point they would not have been allowed invest unless they had a qualified international status or something like that. It was the only time that they were allowed to do it.
Okay. And the main driver of markets yesterday was the sharp fall in oil prices.
Yeah, it's been a steady thing over the last kind of 2 to 3 weeks, and with everything else that's been going on in terms of central bank meetings and everything else, it's kind of got pushed to the back pages a little bit. But you know, it's certainly back with a vengeance yesterday. You know, needless to say, everybody's talking about an oil Armageddon now, and prices back to where we were at the start of February.
$45 or $46 a barrel.
$46 a barrel. Now, you know, February of 2016, that was down at $28, $29. Everybody's saying, oh, it could potentially go like that. Who knows at this stage? It is the middle of the summer. But you know, we might see a reaction now out of the likes of OPEC, etc., to see if there's further production cuts to come.
Might be the story of the summer yet, along with Brexit, of course. Aidan Donnelly of Davy, as always, thanks for joining us. It's 6:44. You're listening to Breakfast Business with Vincent Wall. The financial crisis that swamped many of the world's larger banks from 2008 onwards simply won't go away at Barclays in the UK. After a 5-year investigation there, the Serious Fraud Office has now laid criminal charges against the bank itself and 4 former executives. Susie Ring, Bloomberg Investigations reporter, has been following the story and joins us now from London. Susie, this all boils down to how new capital was raised in Qatar back in 2008 by Barclays.
That's right. You know, it all goes back to that time in 2008, that apocalyptic time where, you know, the banks were struggling for capital. We obviously saw a number of other banks bailed out by the state, but Barclays managed to avoid that situation by entering into a deal with a number of investors in Qatar and other places such as Abu Dhabi. But these charges relate to the arrangements that they entered into with the Qatari investors and some side deals that they agreed as part of that, which have now come in for question.
And we won't get into the detail of this, Susie, and we probably can't, but effectively the gist of the Serious Fraud Office allegation is that, I suppose, palms were greased to a certain extent, consultancies in Qatar, and the whole thing was less than transparent.
Yeah, the two things that are under question here are there was one payment made of £322 million as sort of what was dubbed a consultancy agreement at the time, that's now coming for question as to what did that consultancy agreement really mean, and what was the nature of that payment, as well as a $3 billion loan facility that was made available to the Qataris in exchange for the fundraising, which again has raised questions as to why that was made available.
Now, the investigation has been ongoing for 5 years, and in fact, the decision to charge was delayed a number of times already this year. But it's still pretty stunning to see a whole corporation, a bank, charged with a criminal charge, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen nothing like it. This is definitely one of, if not the biggest case that we've seen come out of the UK Serious Fraud Office. Under English law, it's actually very difficult to charge companies. You need to have the so-called directing mind of the upper echelons of the company. Obviously, the nature of this investigation meant that that was the only part in terms of individuals of the company that was being looked at, which has enabled them to be able to charge the bank as well as individuals. But yes, this is really unprecedented in terms of the level of executives that we're seeing, and in terms of charges actually against a bank, and particularly a bank of Barclays' size.
And of course, it does involve the former chief executive of Barclays at the time, John Varley. Looking at some of the UK media this morning, there's a feeling in some quarters that perhaps, you know, this has dragged on for so long that it's nearly 10 years now. There's still a lot of anger in Ireland about what happened back then when it emerges through the courts in various ways. Is there the same anger among taxpayers and the public generally in the UK about what was done back then or allegedly done?
I think there has been, and that's one of the interesting questions that obviously Barclays raises, because it did actually avoid a bailout by taking this money from Qatari investors, so taxpayers weren't affected. And that was actually quite controversial at the time. The government wanted Barclays to take a bailout, and it decided not to. There is that anger. I mean, these investigations, they do drag on for years because of the complexity of the nature, and obviously these things often aren't discovered until well after the event. This has been something that the SFO has been criticised for in the past, and is also now facing questions over its own future after we saw in the Conservative manifesto plans to wrap the SFO into the National Crime Agency. I think some people are wondering whether this sort of high-profile case could be the sort of thing that will save that from now happening.
And the SFO, as you say, it's a big issue for them as well. And they haven't a completely untarnished reputation when in terms of bringing senior bank executives to trial, have they?
No, it's been a rocky road for them. We saw with the libel prosecution some successes, some what we sort of so-called failures, which would be acquittals. And we have seen this sort of new level of leadership, I'd say, under the current director. He now has only less than a year to run, though. So with its future in the balance as far as the Tory plans go, and with his tenure coming to an end, does raise questions as to what's going to happen to its future, who's going to be there to fight for it to remain as an independent agency rather than being absorbed by the National Crime Agency, which is something that actually has been a government plan for, or something raised by Theresa May for a number of years since she was Home Secretary, and hasn't happened yet. And yes, so I imagine we'll be hoping that this latest case can stall that a little bit further.
Okay, and that's due to come to trial in London in early July. Susie Ring of Bloomberg, thanks indeed for filling in us on that. It's 6:53 on Breakfast Business. Members of the Conservative Cabinet in the UK, of all Brexit hues, have stressed this week that the UK still plans to leave the EU Single Market and Customs Union. If so, exports of farm produce and food face significant tariffs, not only between the Republic and the UK, but at the Irish border. All parties to the Brexit talks suggest they're mindful of the impact of a hard Brexit on Irish-UK trade, but few have yet proposed a solution. Phelim O'Neill, market specialist and Brussels correspondent with the Farmers Journal, has proposed one though, and he joins us now on the phone. Phelim, what's your solution?
Good morning, Vincent. I think because of the unique problem that Brexit presents agriculture on the island of Ireland, a unique situation or a new creation has to be found to deal with it. Now, it's all right saying that it doesn't fit within existing models. The reality of life is that nothing will address that that comes from existing models. And I suppose if we look at the situation, what is needed? Ireland needs access to the UK for our beef and for our cheddar, our mushrooms and our pigs going north. Northern Ireland needs access south of the border for about a quarter to a third of his milk that comes south for processing. And about, 40 or 45% of his lamb production, over 400,000 lambs every year. So I think if we look across and if we think, a bit broader, we look at Bushmills whiskey, for example, is treated as Irish whiskey, even though it's made in the north. Bailey's Irish Cream is another product that's very much associated as being Irish. A lot of the milk for it comes from Northern Ireland. So if we can, and if the EU and the UK, and the one thing they seem to have a consensus on at the moment is they need to find a model to deal with the Irish border, and they don't. There seems to be genuine goodwill towards Ireland from both sides. So therefore, I think if we look at this creatively, if we can find, and the EU27 and the UK can come to an arrangement that will allow Irish beef continued access to the UK on the present terms that we have at the moment, if we can be allowed to send our pigs and our cheddar into the UK or into Northern Ireland as appropriate, and in turn that we can accommodate a continued flow of the lamb and a continued flow of the milk in a new structure. We can't talk about special status for Northern Ireland because that's politically unacceptable. But if we can think imaginatively, as is the case with Bushmills whiskey, where it is given an Irish identity, even though it's strictly speaking produced outside the jurisdiction.
So
there's a model in there.
Are you talking, Phelim, about an island of Ireland designation for specific products that it wouldn't really matter which part of the island it came from and would have free trade throughout the islands?
That it would enable that to take place, and we wouldn't even necessarily call it a designation, because at the end of the day, the Northern Ireland origin product will always be part of the UK, because Northern Ireland is part of the UK, and I think we have to recognise and accept that, just as we do with Bushmills whiskey at the moment. But the turn or the quid pro quo for that has to be access to the UK for Irish beef. It's a whole new model, it's something completely different, but look, to have a serious solution, because agriculture is the one we hear so much about German cars and the impact of that. The reality of life is that Germany with six times the sales to the UK that Ireland has, would ultimately finish up paying less tariff than Ireland would with just 5% of sales. So there has to be a truly unique solution found to a truly unique problem, because there's no other sector of the economy that has the problem with Brexit that Irish agriculture has.
Wouldn't such a scenario be open to abuse, though, Phelim, in the sense that, cheese or other products could come in from the EU into a republic and then be moved on into the UK Irish produce?
And again, that's something that we have thought of as well. And I suppose the unique place that agriculture finds itself in, because of different issues over the years with BSE for disease controls for horse meat, etc., there's now a system of traceability within agri-food produce that's second to none. This is probably unrivaled in any other category. Currently, movements of sheep come south. There is a veterinary certification with those, as there is with cattle going north. Every piece of meat that goes from the UK to Ireland has a unique identifier on it. So therefore, everything is easily traced within that. I can visualise that in a post-Brexit situation, there would probably be further checks, but those can be carried out at the factories or at the place of dispatch. It doesn't necessarily need to be at a border as such. And the system that's there at the moment to ensure that there's no fraudulent trading going on or product identification fraud going on, that can be enhanced, or it can even incorporate a customs inspections element to it. I think it's very important that product integrity is maintained at all time, but I've no doubt that the present structures would accommodate that.
Very briefly, Phelim, you say that there's actually a stick element to this for the EU as well, because otherwise a lot of our beef and cheddar will be dumped on their markets.
Absolutely. I use the term refugee beef to describe it. If this level of tariffs were imposed on Irish beef, simply that trade for 250,000 tonnes of product, over half our production, could no longer take place. It wouldn't be economically viable. Where else does that go? It has to go to the rest of the EU27, and that would absolutely decimate beef markets across the continent. So in terms of avoiding a situation where we create this refugee beef, then if we have some sort of a model like this, it would prevent that, and there would be wins all round from it. Of course, nothing beats what we have at the present. Ideally, the UK would remain the single market in the customs union. I suppose the model I'm thinking of is, for the worst case scenario, that we'll have to find a complete new structure.
Hopefully somebody's listening. Phelim O'Neill of the Farmers Journal, thanks indeed for joining us this morning. That's it from Breakfast Business, from Vincent Wall.
News Talk Breakfast, in association with AIR, supporting your business on our mobile network, right across Ireland.